damn it, I see,
he kept saying. I say we commit Bravo now, a perfect exploitation of the success you had this afternoon. If we've got Googs up there, like you've been telling everyone, then we'll find out for sure when Bravo hits Helicopter Hill. If things get too tight, we'll just walk them back to that LZ Fitch told us about and yank them out. Simpson stopped pacing and looked at the map. If we wait around, Blakely went on, we'll end up watching Nagulian fade across the border. You'll never prove your case. Commit Bravo and prove your point. Then Mulvaney's got to let you commit the rest of the battalion to support them. Once Bravo's engaged, it'll be just what Mulvaney needs to get his ass off the dime. A bunch of grunts fighting like hell and a bunch of grunts waiting to wade in and help them. Otherwise, he's liable to back off. Worry about patrolling his fucking fire bases. He's still in Korea taking hills. It's attrition that counts in this war. Turf doesn't mean jack shit. Simpson felt the nervous chill that men feel when faced with decisions that they know can bring the fulfillment or the ruin of their dreams and ambitions. He paced back and forth. He kept looking at the map. He wanted a drink, but he knew he couldn't take one in front of Blakely. Sir, the sensor reports confirm what you've suspected all along as well. Your case is airtight.
God damn it, Blakely, let me think!
Blakely kept silent. After about 3 minutes, Simpson leaned over, his knuckles on the plywood table, and looked up at Blakely.
All right, by God, we'll do it!
His eyes were shining with excitement. Then he reached for the glass. After making the decision to attack, Blakely and Simpson both grew concerned that sending Bravo in right away might be too hasty. It would require a platoon to move the wounded to a safe LZ. This could entail an assault with only two platoons, which would look bad if it failed. They could, of course, take the risk of guarding the wounded with only a squad, but if the squad was overwhelmed and they had evidence from Sweet Alice that a company was in the area, that would be even harder to explain. If they tried to medevac the wounded, they risked losing a chopper, and that wouldn't look good either. They both knew that bold moves might have been all right for Stonewall Jackson or George Patton, but this was a different kind of war. They played safe. The first frag order told Fitch to send a platoon to the LZ with the wounded. Fitch sent Malisoff with Fracasso, who was jumpy after having gone into a hot zone on his first day of command. Mellis humped along in the rear with Bass, shooting the shit, happy to be back with his old platoon. He watched with satisfaction as Fracasso led the platoon to the LZ, accomplished the medevacs, and guided the platoon back by a different route to link up with the rest of the company, now in position closer to the ridge. There, Fitch had set the company in on a small rise of ground, 50 meters inside the protective cover of the jungle. The jungle edged a broad patch of elephant grass on the valley floor immediately below the approaches to Matterhorn. This all took until nightfall, giving the NVA plenty of time to dig in on Helicopter Hill. The second frag order came at twilight. Long before Relsnik finished decoding the order, it was apparent that an assault was being ordered. Goodwin sauntered up to the CP group. He was eating a can of spaghetti and meatballs mixed with a package of Weiler's lemonade powder.
"What's up, Jack?"
he asked Fitch. "We're going to take the hill at first light."
"Matterhorn?"
"No, Helicopter Hill." Goodwin whistled.
"Just like in the movies," he said.
"Let's hope so," Fitch replied, spreading his map. Looking at Matterhorn and Helicopter Hill as an attacker, Mellis wondered how he could have been so frightened when he was defending it. Steep fingers led up to the top, divided by steep, heavily jungled gullies. To stay in contact as they advanced, they would have to move in single file. But to move the entire company single file would take hours, exposing them to mortar attack and a possible flanking movement. To attack from the west, north, or south exposed them to automatic weapons fire from the bunkers on Matterhorn. To attack from the east would mean channeling their attack into a narrow front perfect for defensive machine gun fire and mortars. Then there was the support problem. They'd have to rely on air. One plan was scratched. A second was proposed, and then a third. It grew darker. They huddled over the map with their red lens flashlights. Every plan had a flaw. After 3 hours of debate, they finally realized that there was no perfect plan. Somebody was going to get killed. Melis sat down with his head in his hands, rubbing his eyes, wishing fervently that Hawk was still with them. He now regretted telling Blakely that Hawk wanted out of the bush and that the battalion might lose him if Blakely didn't act fast. This was a big part of the reason why Hawk wasn't with them. It was all absurd, without reason or meaning. People who didn't even know each other were going to kill each other over a hill none of them cared about. The wind picked up slightly, bringing the smell of the jungle with it. Melis shivered. He couldn't figure out why they didn't just quit. Yet they wouldn't. They finally decided to move Fracasso's 1st Platoon and Kendall's 3rd Platoon up a long finger that led south from the main ridgeline, starting just east of Helicopter Hill. When they reached the main east-west ridgeline, 1st Platoon would attack westward and hit Helicopter Hill from the east. They would be supported by Kendall's platoon, which would also act as the reserve. Kendall would set up on a little hump just behind 1st Platoon's line of departure, from where they could fire over 1st Platoon's heads. Goodwin's 2nd Platoon would simultaneously move up a narrower finger that paralleled the one the main body would take and was just to the west of it. Instead of joining the main ridge line, however, the narrower finger led directly into the south side of Helicopter Hill. The Air Force's defoliation had not been as successful on that finger, so there was good cover almost to the top. Goodwin was to get online, draping his platoon across the top of the finger and down both sides, if possible without being detected, and attack from the south when Fitch felt the enemy was fully engaged with 1st Platoon on the east side. In this way, 2nd Platoon would be concealed longer and, once released, would be exposed to fire from Matterhorn itself, which was directly to the finger's west, for the shortest possible time. Approaching in the dark would eliminate fire on Goodwin's platoon from Matterhorn before the assault, but only if they weren't detected. In fact, a large part of the plan depended on Goodwin's getting into position undetected. When daylight broke and the assault began, Goodwin's platoon would quickly be mingled with NVA troops on Helicopter Hill, and the NVA on Matterhorn would probably have to hold their fire. Of course, the main issue was the defenders of Helicopter Hill itself. Still, Fitch hoped the dead branches of the defoliated jungle just below the hill might give some concealment and cover if they could attack during the poor light of early morning. That meant everything had to go at dawn, and, he hoped, with the clouds low to the ground. On the other hand, if clouds were close to the ground, there was no hope for air support. "Fucking brilliant," Melis said. "It took us 3 fucking hours to figure out we'll just charge the motherfuckers." It was almost with relief that he threw himself into planning the mechanics of departure lines, timing, air coordination, and smoke and hand signals. They filed out into the blackness of the jungle at 0100, emerging an hour later into the high grass on the valley's floor. Low clouds, drizzle, and darkness hid Matterhorn and the ridgeline completely. Melis felt as if his map and the dim red spot of his flashlight were the only reality in a darkness that oppressed not only sight, but the mind as well. They reached the point where Goodwin's platoon was to veer off to the west to begin moving up its assigned finger. Everyone quietly dropped his pack. This was so everyone could save energy on the climb, free themselves for instant and fast movement when the action started, and avoid unnecessary noise. They took only water, canteens topped to prevent the sound of water sloshing, and 2 cans of food carefully wrapped in socks to avoid the sound of cans clinking together. Ammunition was carefully placed in cloth pockets. Faces were smeared with clay and dirt. Even unburdened of their packs, they moved very slowly. The tiniest sounds rang out like bells. Unseen branches slapped at their eyes. The cold fog enveloped them. The kids cursed beneath their breath as they groped for the ground in front of them. They silently cleared limbs from their faces, biting back the need to vent their anger at the pain. They crawled over downed trees, squeezed through thick brambles. Moving quietly in the dark takes a great deal of time. Too much time. Dawn was breaking. An explosion ahead of the main body sent everyone down to his stomach. A long, wailing scream hung in the air. Sam, directly behind Malice, rose to his feet and whispered,
"Shut the fucker up, somebody! Shut that son of a bitch up!"
First and third platoon had lost the advantage of surprise. The scream stopped abruptly. The stillness of the jungle after that anguished sound was like ether-laden cotton. Numbing. Oppressive. Dangerous. Everyone wondered what had happened to cause such pain, and how it had ended. It had ended when Jankiewicz shut his eyes and jammed his fist into the hole left by the blown-away lower jaw of the kid who had been on point. The shrapnel from the DH-10 directional mine had taken out his eyes and lower jaw, but had left his vocal cords intact. One foot had been ripped off as well. Jankiewicz pulled his bloody hand from the mess around the kid's throat. A piece of jawbone with two teeth in it caught on the opal ring Susie had bought for him. Fredrickson rushed up and pinched the spurting carotid artery with one hand while he fumbled to stuff a thick bandage pad against the stump of the lower leg. Jankiewicz touched Fredrickson on the shoulder and shook it gently. "Let him die, Doc," he said. Fredrickson hesitated, then let go of the artery. The blood oozed out quickly, no longer spurting. "Who was it?" Fredrickson asked quietly, blood smeared on his face. The face before him was unrecognizable. "Royer." Fracasso, who had been anxiously watching Fredrickson's efforts, backed away involuntarily, bumping into Hamilton.
"Excuse me," Fracasso mumbled.
They wrapped Breuer's body in his poncho and put his black plastic glasses in the pocket of his utility jacket. Then they rolled the poncho's edges for hand grips. Fredrickson put the medevac number in his notebook along with the cause of death. Fracasso put Jacobs's squad on point. They continued moving awkwardly forward to get into position for the assault, knowing there would be no surprise in their favor. Their main hope now shifted to Goodwin, if only he could work his way up undetected. The fog swirled around them. The fear of mines dogged every step. Breuer's body slowed them considerably. Big John Six was frantic.
"It's damn near 0830. They were supposed to be at their FLD 3 hours ago. I knew I should have shit-canned that goddamn Fitch."
Hawk listened, knowing that Fitch would have been extremely fortunate to make the FLD, the final line of departure, on time. He was more worried about the weather than Fitch's failure to kick off on schedule. Air support, holding in tight circles within easy striking distance of the target, had to have clear weather and had to strike before running short of fuel. Captain Bainford threw his pencil across the bunker and leaned back in his chair to look at Simpson and Blakely. He'd had four F-4 Phantoms waiting above the clouds, but they had gone bingo fuel and had to return to base. He cursed about Fitch's inability to stick to a schedule. One of the radio operators picked up Bainford's pencil.
"What about the Navy?"
Simpson asked. Bainford sighed.
"I'll try, sir, but they gotta be able to see what they're bombing just like everyone else."
Bainford went back to the radio, trying to drum up another flight to wait above the towering clouds that hid the western mountains. At that moment, Goodwin was quietly spreading his platoon out in a long frontal line, preparing to move from the cover of the trees up the defoliated slopes of Helicopter Hill. He keyed the handset to signal his arrival. Fitch checked his watch. The company had been moving nearly 8 hours without rest or food. Fitch could only guess how far away he was from his own final line of departure. Robertson emerged from behind a thick cover of bush and caught movement in a tree from the corner of his eye. An NVA soldier was taking a piss, holding onto a branch and making patterns on the ground below him with his urine. Robertson said,
"Oh, shit,"
and fell backward firing his M16. At the same time, a second NVA soldier in the tree let loose with a long burst from his AK-47. The one who had been taking a piss jumped to the ground, running hard. His friend toppled over backward with Robertson's bullets running up the inside of his body. The radios crackled to life.
"We're committed," Fitch said, "and radio silence, over."
The company surged forward, still in single file, behind Fracasso, who emerged from the shelter of the jungle onto the defoliated crest of the main ridgeline and went running across, down the north side, spreading the platoon in a single line behind him as he went. He stopped, setting them in place, and then returned to the center, moving in a crouch behind them as they lay looking intently at their objective. Helicopter Hill's bald outline wavered in the gray fog. It had changed considerably, having been made into an auxiliary LZ by the artillery battery. The trees blasted clear for 40 or 50 meters from the crest, and all the remaining trees and brush killed by defoliating chemicals. The NVA had also built bunkers that were plainly visible near the top of the hill, which was about 100 meters above the ridge on which Fracasso was crouched. The ridge sloped gradually upward from him toward the west. About 300 meters from where he was, it merged into Helicopter Hill, which rose abruptly and steeply from the ridge like a large knuckle. From the map, and from interviewing everyone he could, Fracasso knew that the much larger bulk of Matterhorn stood behind Helicopter Hill, about 600 meters to its west, hidden from his view. Matterhorn's summit, with its flattened LZ and abandoned artillery positions, was about 200 meters higher than Helicopter Hill. That was within rifle range, and Fracasso didn't like it. For now, however, he had other things to worry about. Kendall and Sams set 3rd Platoon into position, pecking everyone on the small hump behind 1st Platoon in tears, thankful they had gone into the hot zone first the day before, yet feeling guilty and anxious for the Marines of 1st Platoon, who lay silently on the ground in front of them. Mellis joined Fitch and the command post group on the top of the little hump. Bass and Fracasso moved from kid to kid, patting rumps or legs, checking equipment, going over the smoke and hand signals for the 20th time, comforting them with the thought of jets standing by, even though everyone knew the clouds would keep the jets away. Maybe the skipper won't send us in without air, they thought. That hope died when Fitch picked up the hook.
Okay, Bravo One. Pop smoke when you want fire. Good luck.
Over.
Aye, aye, skipper, Fracasso answered.
Everyone lay staring ahead at the dead shrubs and defoliated trees on the hill. Fracasso looked down the line to where Bass was crouched with Skosh. Bass was looking at him, waiting for the signal to go. Fracasso crossed himself. Then he stood up and waved his arm forward toward the hill. Bass imitated his signal for those who couldn't see Fracasso. Every Marine rose to his feet, switched off his safety, and walked forward. There would be no running. To reach the summit of the hill in a state of exhaustion would mean almost certain death. They walked, waiting for the enemy to open fire. Mellis, watching 1st Platoon's backs, kept asking in a whisper,
"Why? Why? Why?"
At the same time, immense excitement gripped him. He turned to Fitch.
"You don't need me here. I'm going with 1st Platoon."
And not knowing why himself, he ran to catch up with the slowly moving platoon. Running to rejoin them, he felt overwhelming joy. It was as if he were coming home from a lashing winter storm to the warmth of his living room. The sky seemed brilliantly blue and clear, although he knew it was overcast. If he didn't move his legs faster, his heart would outpace his feet and burst. His heart. His whole body was overflowing with an emotion that he could only describe as love. He came up beside Bass, panting from the run, and settled in on the southern downhill side of the ridge, a few meters to Bass's right. Bass had placed himself between Jacobs's squad on his left and Jankowicz's squad, which held the middle position of the line and was draped over the ridge. Fracasso had given Jankowicz the middle position because of the skill and experience it would take to keep the squad from splitting in half if gravity and fear pulled people in its middle downhill from the ridgeline. Fracasso had placed himself just off the ridgeline on the northern side. There he could see where Jankowicz's right flank met Connolly's squad, which held the far right of the line, and endeavored to keep the two squads from splitting apart. At the same time, he could pop up over the top of the ridge and see where Jacobs's squad was, although he was relying heavily on Bass to keep them formed up with the rest of the line. They were about 100 meters from the base of the hill when a machine gun opened up from low on the hill, lacing a long line of bullets directly down the crest of the ridge, swaying slightly to both sides of the crest. The line of Marines hesitated only for a moment, ducking more from instinct than anything else. The three squad leaders, Bass and Fracasso, immediately pushed forward to maintain the deliberate walking pace. The whole line continued forward with no one right on the ridge's crest where the machine gun bullets kicked up mud. The gun was well placed. It denied the easiest approach to the hill, forced the attackers onto steeper ground on the sides of the ridge, and widened the gap between them. Fracasso ran forward of the line, just off the north side of the ridge, where the machine gun bullets flew over his head. Hamilton ran beside him with the heavy radio. Then Fracasso popped a red smoke grenade and Hamilton radioed for 3rd Platoon to open up behind them. The morning air was shattered by the combined fire of 40 rifles and 3 machine guns. 1st Platoon surged forward, now running in short bursts of speed, the kids throwing themselves to the ground to fire upward, then moving again, ever higher. The ground on the side of the hill was churning with the bullets being poured into it by 3rd Platoon. The Marines of 1st Platoon hit the steep bank, the line of advance folding in on itself in a crescent, and moved up the slope in disciplined short bursts, a movement that had been drilled into the Marines from their first day at boot camp. Some of them were shouting to keep their spirits up. Some were shouting from sheer excitement. A few fired their rifles up the slope, but most simply held their fire, knowing that the angle was poor. About 25 meters up the hillside, Fracasso popped a green smoke to signal 3rd Platoon to stop firing. Fitch called off the fire of 3rd Platoon to avoid hitting his own men. There was a second or two of silence. Then Helicopter Hill exploded with the steady, ear-splitting fire of heavy machine guns and the flat clatter of the solid automatic AK-47 and semi-automatic SKS rifles of the North Vietnamese Army. Now the ground beneath 1st Platoon's feet spat up dirt and mud, some of it tinted dark red. Mellis ran forward, throwing himself behind rocks, scrambling across exposed patches, and then lunging again for any sort of cover from the fire pouring down on them. All of his being was wound up in his pumping heart and the rapidly rising heat of the blood coursing through his brain and legs. The kids were running and dodging in groups of 2 and 3. Fracasso was trying hard to keep the platoon together. Connolly's squad, on the north side of the ridge, was bunched together, leaving a large gap between it and Jankiewicz, who had half his squad on one side of the ridge and half on the other. Jacobs, on the south side, had his squad moving forward in rushes, 2 fire teams shooting while the 3rd scrambled forward. The NVA, no longer pinned down by 3rd Platoon's fire, maintained its own fierce fire. The world seemed to turn over as Mellis watched soft flesh run against hot metal. What moments before had been organized movement now disintegrated into confusion, noise, and blood. The attack might have looked as if it were still being directed by the leaders, but it wasn't. It went forward because each Marine knew what to do. Mellis was transported outside himself, beyond himself. It was as if his mind watched everything coolly while his body raced wildly with passion and fear. He was frightened beyond any fear he had ever known. But this brilliant and intense fear, this terrible here and now, combined with the crucial significance of every movement of his body, pushed him over a barrier whose existence he had not known about until this moment. He gave himself over completely to the god of war within him. A burst of machine gun bullets cracked over his head as he ran parallel to the contour of the hill to try and help get the squads back together again. He heard screams for a corpsman. He ran toward the sounds and found Doc Fredrickson already there. 2 kids were down, one still breathing raggedly, the other shot through the upper teeth, a gaping exit hole in the back of his head. The 2 remaining fire team members were still moving upward against the fire. Mellis ran after them. He saw Jacobs crouching behind a small outcropping as he moved forward against a machine gun emplacement. Young scrambled up beside Jacobs, set the bipod at the end of his machine gun barrel on a small hump, and began a steady fire against the NVA machine gun. This enabled the two remaining kids from the fire team to keep crawling up the hill, grenades in their hands.
"Where's Jermaine?" Mellis shouted at Jacobs. "We need a fucking M79!
Jacobs turned and looked down at Mellis, who was just below him. He pointed. Mellis raced away, using the steepness of the hill for cover. Bullets passed over his head. He found Jermaine crawling cautiously upward through the thick bushes, his stubby M79 grenade launcher pushed out in front of him.
"We need grenades!" Mellis shouted. "Machine gun bunker! Jacobs is going after it!"
Mellis turned around, not even looking to see if Jermaine would follow, and not thinking for a moment that he wouldn't. Jermaine ran after him. The earth was spattering on the front of the small hump and on both sides of Young. His teeth were bared and his face was contorted with fear as he and the NVA machine gunner locked on each other, bullets flying between them. But Young continued firing in short, disciplined bursts so as not to overheat his barrel, leaving the others free to move. Jermaine shouted at Robertson and two new kids in his fire team above him to get down. Then he stood up, exposing himself to the fire, and began to pump grenades at the opening of the bunker. The NVA machine gun stopped firing. Then Robertson and the two other kids crawled to their knees and scrambled up to the side of the bunker to finish it off. Mellis was already running away, having done all he could. He didn't see one of the kids crumple to the ground, shot in the back from a hidden hole to the right of the bunker. Robertson rolled forward into the cover of the bushes, throwing both his grenades into the open hole and killing the two North Vietnamese who were firing from it. Without grenades, however, he was now ineffective against the bunker with the machine gun. He lay on his back and cradled his rifle on his chest. The machine gun opened up again. Young responded. This left Jacobs to figure out what to do next. Mellis ran behind Jankowitz's squad. They were bunching up, making it easier for the NVA gunners, and the terrain was forcing them, unwitting, toward the easier but far more deadly approach of the top of the ridgeline. Mellis saw Bass and screamed at him,
"Get those stupid fuckers off that ridgeline!"
Bass nodded, gasping for air, and ran forward, Skosh dogging his heels with the radio. Mellis moved straight up the hill. Pollini was there, frantically trying to clear his weapon. Pollini kept looking above him, nodded his weapon, jamming the action over and over again. It took no time for Mellis to figure out the trap. The bushes directly in front of Pollini had been cut away from the ground level up to about 2 feet, and then the branches had been left in their normal state. It was a clear field of fire for a machine gun that would chop down the advancing man's legs, causing him to fall into the bullets.
"Give me that fucking rifle, Short Round," Mellis shouted.
His voice was barely audible above the noise. Pollini handed Mellis the rifle as if it might explode any second. He looked at Mellis wildly, then looked downhill to what seemed like safety. Then he grinned at Mellis.
"It's jammed, sir."
Mellis quickly saw that Pollini hadn't seated his magazine completely, and the upper edge was blocking the passage of the bolt. Mellis shook his head and snapped the magazine into place. He fired a short burst. The hot shell casings poured out, hitting Pollini on the side of the face. That snapped Pollini back to the situation at hand. He grinned and reached for his rifle, once again looking uphill through the tunnel of cleared brush.
"You okay, Short Round?"
Mellis asked. Pollini smiled, gulped, and nodded.
"Yeah, fucking stuck, huh, sir?"
"Yeah, well, it's unstuck now. You watch it. There's a fucking machine gun right above you."
Mellis moved away, looking for Jankowitz. Pollini scrambled to his feet and darted up the hill. He ran straight up the carefully cleared path, disappearing from Mellis's view before Mellis could tackle him. The machine gun opened up, and Mellis lunged behind a small lip as the bullets chopped up mud and branches. The gun stopped. In the brief silence, he heard Pollini shout,
"I'm hit! I'm hit!"
Mellis hugged the earth when the gun started again, hoping Pollini would crawl back. He didn't. Bass came around the side of the hill.
"Who's hit?"
he asked.
"Short Round,"
Mellis said, crawling backward toward Bass, who was leaning on his side against the steep slope. Skosh was crouched at his feet, trying to listen to the radio, one hand over his exposed ear. Bass looked up the hill.
"There's a fucking machine gun up there, sir."
"I know."
"Short Round's alive. I heard him yell."
"Me too,"
Bass said.
"But it's suicide to get him from here.
We'll work around it. It's dug in, but it's not in a bunker like the other one. Maybe a Mike 26.
Doc Fredrickson came scrambling into the relative safety beneath the hill's crest where the three of them crouched. He leaned back against the hill, chest heaving, and stared down the long ridgeline where several bodies lay exposed. He wasn't listening to the conversation. Mellis turned to Bass and grinned.
"What do you think, Sergeant Bass? Is it worth at least a Navy Commendation Medal if I go get him?"
Mellis intended this as a joke, but realized he was partially serious. Bass looked at him. He was not in a joking mood.
"You'll get killed up there, Lieutenant. Don't do it."
Mellis was suddenly determined to get a medal. Moreover, it was his fault that Pollini wasn't on KP duty back at VCB. He turned to Fredrickson.
"Wait here until I get him down."
Fredrickson was still catching his breath and didn't respond. Bass said,
"Okay, sir, I'll try and give you some cover. If you get killed, I'll put you in for a posthumous Bronze Star. It's a deal."
Up until this moment, Mellis had felt as though he were in a movie. Now, faced with the consequences of his decision, he sensed that the film was about to break in two. Sudden, searing white light. And then nothing. He watched Skosh and Bass crawl slowly into place to his left. He nodded at them and they raised their rifles over the lip of the hill and opened up. Mellis whirled to his feet and went charging over the small crest, throwing his body forward on the ground, firing blindly uphill, hoping to keep the machine gunner's head down as he crawled forward. Pollini was sprawled on his back, feet pointing uphill toward the machine gun. Mellis hit the ground below Pollini's head. He reached up and tried to pull Pollini downhill by dragging on his utility shirt at the shoulders. The machine gun opened up as soon as Mellis stopped firing. Mellis tugged but couldn't get sufficient leverage to move Pollini's weight. He cursed. He tugged again. He couldn't move him. Bullets snapped past his ears. He fired a last, desperate burst from his M16 directly over Pollini's body and scrambled up beside him. He turned himself around and threw himself on top of Pollini, hugging him face to face. Wrapping his arms around him, he jacked the two of them sideways on the steep hillside and then quickly rolled downhill, pulling Pollini on top of him as he rolled. Mellis felt bullets impacting all around him. With every roll, he hoped it was Pollini and not him who would catch the bullet. Suddenly, the earth gave way and he fell over the embankment. Fredrickson was waiting there. He pulled Pollini free. Pollini's breathing had stopped. There was blood coming from his mouth. Bass and Skosh came running around the corner of the embankment, and the three of them watched in silence. The objective of taking the hill and the terrific noise and confusion raging about them were forgotten as they watched Fredrickson try to save Pollini's life. Fredrickson was blowing air into Pollini's mouth, spitting out blood and vomit between breaths. He did this for at least a minute, then looked up at the other three, defeat on his face. He moved aside some matted, bloody hair on the top of Pollini's head and exposed a small, round hole. Mellis remembered that, at the top of the hill, Pollini's helmet had been behind him on the ground.
"There's nothing I can do for him, sir," Fredrickson said, grief and helplessness showing on his face. "He's got a bullet inside his head someplace. I don't see no exit hole."
Mellis nodded and looked at Bass and Skosh.
"Fucking short round,"
Skosh said quietly and turned away, his jaw working, looking uphill. The machine gun opened up, its heavy rounds slamming through the air. They heard grenades going off, then silence. Then the machine gun opened up again. Mellis forgot about Pollini and ran off toward the sounds. He came upon Amarillo, who was crawling forward and joined him. Sweat ran down Amarillo's face.
"Jank, sir," he said. "He's going after that gun. He has Jackson's team with him."
Mellis could see nothing of Jackson or Jankowitz. He looked behind him. A new kid was hunched over in a little ball, a bullet through his shoulder and neck. Mellis didn't even know his name. Amarillo saw Mellis looking at the dead Marine.
"He's Tubut from ITR. He goes running up against the machine gun."
Mellis didn't answer. Both of them overcame their desire to stay hugging the earth and scrambled forward. Jackson was moving his team in small rushes, closing in on the gun. No Marines were firing.
"Where's Jank?"
Mellis shouted. Jackson pointed ahead.
"He took off around the side, sir. We don't know where the fuck he's at."
Mellis now understood why no one was shooting. They heard roaring bursts of fire and yelling to their left, but Mellis barely registered this. It was Goodwin's platoon just released by Fitch. In the midst of the roaring, they caught glimpses of Jankiewicz's head above the bushes. He was running directly along the contour of the hill, taking the NVA machine gun from the side. He fired a burst from his M16. A man next to the machine gunner turned his AK-47 on Jankiewicz, but Jank kept running forward. Jackson saw the gunner turn the machine gun toward Jankiewicz. He scrambled to his feet and charged up the hill, screaming, "Jank, you stupid motherfucker! You crazy, stupid motherfucker!" Jankiewicz released the spoon of his grenade as the gunner got the machine gun turned around and opened up on him. Jank seemed to throw the grenade and go down simultaneously, bullets bursting out of the backside of his flak jacket. Then his grenade went off like a sudden hand clap in an empty room. Cortell went running after Jackson, firing quick bursts at the gun pit. Then, as if jerked by an unseen hand, Cortell's neck snapped backward and his helmet went spinning into the air behind him. He sank to his knees, staring stupidly at his rifle, which he was holding horizontally in front of him. Then he collapsed forward, ending up with his bare head on the ground like a Muslim at prayer. Jackson kept running forward, trying to reach Jankiewicz. Mellis reached Cortell and rolled him over on his side. Cortell's knees were still folded up against his stomach in a fetal position. Blood was running off his forehead and his hair was matted with it. He was gritting his teeth in pain.
"Jank got him, sir," Cortell wheezed. "Jank got him. Oh, Jank. Oh, Lord Jesus."
Mellis grabbed Cortell's gauze bandage package from his belt, ripped open the paper, and slapped it on what looked like a furrow starting at his forehead and going back over the top of his ear. He put Cortell's hand on the bandage, pressing it down hard.
"Don't fucking move it," he said.
He turned back uphill. He passed Jankiewicz's body. Blood was still oozing from beneath the back of his flak jacket. A dark black patch was slowly spreading into both trouser legs. Three facts registered simultaneously. The machine gun was silent. Jankiewicz was dead, and the opening had to be exploited. Mellis turned to his left and saw Goodwin already moving toward him with an entire squad. Goodwin, his natural fighting instincts functioning faster than Mellis was thinking, was already rushing into the gap where the machine gun fire used to be. Within seconds, he and five other Marines were behind the line of holes and bunkers. China, scrambling up the steep slope with a heavy machine gun against his chest, slammed into the earth at the edge of the former NVA machine gun's position. He began laying fire over the NVA fighting holes to Goodwin's right. Mellis immediately saw what China was doing. He kept running. He shouted at Goodwin, who didn't seem to hear him. He ran. He made hand signals at the Marines behind him, redirecting them behind China, taking advantage of the fact that the enemy could no longer stand up long enough to take aim and fire because of the stream of China's bullets. He caught Goodwin's eye, pointed at him, and then pointed left. He pointed at his own chest and then pointed right. Chaos slipped momentarily into order. With 2nd Platoon now pouring through the gap and coming at the NVA from behind them, it seemed as if a heavy weight had been removed.
"They're on the top! I see Scar on the top!"
The cry passed all around the hillside. Fracasso and the Marines of 1st Platoon surged forward. Mellis was exhilarated. All his fear had left him. He ran straight up to the hill's crest, Marines appearing all along the line in small groups and surging through the line of holes. Those NVA soldiers who hadn't been trapped in position were moving in rapid but disciplined flight down a finger to the northwest. What just seconds before had been mad scrambling now turned into methodical and cautious destruction. Grenades were rolled into holes and tossed into the openings of the crude log bunkers. As each NVA position fell, the one next to it became vulnerable. Any NVA soldier trying to break for the jungle was immediately killed by fire from several directions. Mellis met Goodwin at a short trench leading to the dark opening of a bunker. Both had their grenades out. They looked each other in the eye briefly. Then Goodwin nodded, and they both swung in front of the opening, threw their grenades, and dived to the side as the blast came ripping out of the entrance. They crawled in together, firing short bursts on automatic. Mellis was flat on the deck, and Goodwin was just behind him in a crouch so that they could fire their rifles at the same time. There was no one inside. Mellis started to laugh and rolled over on his back, looking up at the roof of the gloomy bunker.
You two guys having fun, eh?
Vancouver was peering through the entrance at them, smiling. His face was streaked with sweat. His machine gun was steaming. His sword was sheathed.
Nagulian went that away.
He pointed toward Matterhorn. Mellis crawled out and sat on top of the bunker, his legs quivering so that he was unable to stand. The battle was over. There were pitifully few dead enemy soldiers to show for it. Goodwin moved off to set in his platoon. Ridlow, wounded in the leg, lay on the hillside, pallid with shock, and waited to be helped up to the LZ. Mellis, still shaking, trotted down the hill to guide in the Marines of 3rd Platoon, who were racing forward to set up for a possible counterattack. Mellis passed Pollini. His eyes were frozen open. He remembered Pollini's voice as he cried out, "I'm hit." How could he cry out if he'd been shot in the head? A guilty, sickening thought wrenched Mellis's stomach. Pollini's head had been pointing downhill. Could he have shot Pollini when he was firing wildly upward, trying to keep the machine gunner's heads down? Mellis stared at Pollini's blank eyes. He sat down beside him, wanting to ask, wanting to explain what he'd done, that he really had wanted to save him, not just add a medal to his list of accomplishments. He had pulled Pollini off KP because he wanted to do right by him. He hadn't meant for him to end up dead. But he could say none of it. Pollini was dead. Mellis tried to put down the thought that he could have killed Pollini. It must have been the gook machine gun. He wanted to leave the doubt behind, buried with the bullet in Pollini's brain. But he knew he never could. If he made it out alive, he'd carry this doubt with him forever. Chapter 14. Victory in combat is like sex with a prostitute. For a moment, you forget everything in the sudden physical rush, but then you have to pay your money to the woman showing you the door. You see the dirt on the walls and your sorry image in the mirror. Thick fog made twilight of mid-morning. It hid the Marines on Helicopter Hill from the sniper fire now coming from the bunkers that Bravo Company had built on Matterhorn. But the fog also kept the helicopters from evacuating the wounded. The Marines dragged their dead friends to a shallow pit near the top of the hill. Mellis and Fitch sat in the dark interior of the bunker Goodwin and Mellis had taken. The fog hung silver-gray in the entrance hole. Fitch started crying in small, silent sobs, the tears running down his dirty cheeks and dripping on the map that lay between him and Mellis. Relznik was transmitting medevac numbers, identifying the dead and wounded.
"Zulu 5, Niner, Niner 1, over."
A bored voice came back over the radio.
"A copy, Zulu 5, Niner, Niner 1, over."
"That's a firm. Bravo Niner 1, 4 Niner, over."
"Hey, is that a Coors 2, over?"
"That's a Raj. These are all Coors."
"Did you copy that last?
Over."
"Roger, I copy Bravo Niner 1, 4 Niner. Give me the next one, over."
And Relznik did, reading them off one by one. The numbers would eventually lead a somber man, sickened by the job he had to do, to some woman's door, to let her know that her husband or son would be coming home wrapped in rubber. The body would arrive in the early morning hours so that the people at the airport wouldn't be disturbed. As he listened to Relznik's voice, Pollini, Papa 7148, Jankowitz, Juliet 6469er, Mellis retreated inside himself. How could it be possible? He analyzed his own moves from the moment he had started helping Pollini with the M16. He'd warned him, but Pollini had gone up. He heard Pollini cry, "I'm hit." Can a man with a head wound do that? But where else was Pollini wounded? What difference did that make? But Pollini had been lying with his head downhill. How did he get that way? An M16 would surely have exploded his head, wouldn't it? But what did a 7.62mm NVA bullet do? Mellis kept part of his mind focused on the physical. Was it his bullet or not? That was a yes or no question, and he had to decide on the answer. The question that was not yes or no was why he had been there with Pellini in the first place. He could have stayed with the CP group, but he'd wanted to help. He'd also wanted to see what the experience was like. He'd found it unbelievably exciting. He'd wanted glory. He could have left Pellini there. Maybe Pellini would still be alive if he had. But he'd wanted to help. He'd wanted a medal. He was the one who had gotten soft and let Pellini off KP. If he'd stuck to his guns, Pellini would be alive at VCB. But Pellini had wanted to be with the company and do his share. Mellis could also have let Fredrickson or someone else crawl after Pellini, or waited until the fighting was over. But he'd wanted to do his share. He'd also wanted a medal. Mellis tried to imagine Goodwin in the same situation. There would have been no conflict. Scar would have wanted to help, and he'd have wanted a medal. Helping and a medal were both good things. The fact that Pellini was dead didn't make the desire for a medal wrong. Did it? What's fucking wrong with wanting a medal? Why did Mellis think it was bad? Why was he so confused? How did he get this way? From where did he dredge up all these doubts? Why? He sighed. He simply wasn't Goodwin. He was himself, and filled with self-doubt. Mellis's reverie was broken by the faint sound of voices crying, "Tubing!" Fitch and Mellis looked at each other, waiting silently for the explosions. "Wait one, we got incoming," Relznick said to the battalion radio operator. He put the handset down beside him. Pallet curled up a little. There was no sound. Then they felt the vibrations through the earth. Then no sound again. "Sounds like they hit down the south side," Mellis said, wanting to break the silence. "The gooners can't adjust in the fog," Fitch said. "Just keeping us honest, I guess." They waited a minute longer. Silence. Fog. Relznick picked up the handset and continued reading the list of medevac numbers. First and second platoons had each lost 6. 5 kids were in serious need of a medevac, and another 12, though not in danger of dying, were fairly useless. Then there were 14 who had received slight flesh wounds or nicks from shrapnel. They included Mellis, whose right hand had taken some of the blast from Jankowitz's grenade. It looked as if he'd fallen on gravel. Normally, small wounds wouldn't be reported, but Fitch had had enough of normality. He told the senior squid, Scheller, to report every nick and scratch on the hill so the medical bureaucracy could grind out purple hearts for as many Marines as possible. 2 hearts and they're out of the bush. 3 and they go to Okinawa to sort socks. I'll be goddamned if I'll stand in their way quibbling over how wounded they got to be to qualify. Every fucking scratch, you understand? Scheller undertook the task with grim pleasure. "Wait one," Relznick said. He turned to Fitch. "Battalion wants a confirmation on that body count?" Fitch sighed. "We haven't killed any more. Tell them it still stands at 10 confirmed and 6 probable."
"Roger that."
Relznick keyed the handset. "Big John, this is Big John Bravo. That's affirmative. 10 confirmed and 6 probables. Over." There was a pause, followed by a new voice.
"Wait one, I'll put him on."
Relznick sighed and handed the handset to Fitch.
"It's the 3.
"This is Bravo 6, over," Fitch said. He held the handset close to his ear, making it difficult for the others to hear, but his answers indicated that apparently the body count was too low. "That's affirmative. We did send people out beyond the holes to count." "Sir, we were attacking fortified bunkers. Over." The handset blurted static, and the 3's voice came over. "Look, Bravo 6, they had to be hurting to leave those 2 open-belt 7.62s behind." Relznick had radioed in about the 2 captured machine guns. One had been taken by Vancouver, The other was the one that Jankowicz had died taking.
I think you easily have twice the probables you've reported. Over.
Tell him you killed a whole fucking 312th Steel Division, Skipper,
Palak said. Fitch held a hand up, annoyed, trying to listen to the three. Yes, Big John 3, you're right on that. Over.
Okay, Bravo 6, we'll see what we can do here. How's everything up there? Over.
We only got enough ammo for one heavy counterattack, and we need water. How are we looking on those medevac birds? Over.
We've got them standing by, Bravo 6. Over.
I've got 5 emergencies up here. If they're not out before dark, they're going to be dead. You tell the fucking zoomies that. Over.
Blakely's voice was curt, controlled.
Bravo 6, I suggest you leave the air evacuations to the forward air controller. I understand you've had a tough day, but you know as well as I do that flying in this kind of weather is idiotic. Over.
Mellis burst out.
What the fuck is sending a company of Marines out in this kind of weather?
Fitch waited for Mellis to finish before he keyed the handset.
I understand. Anything else? Over.
We're preparing a frag order for you, ASAP. Big John 3 out.
At the top of the hill, wraith-like figures moved slowly toward the trench where the dead lay in rows, their weather-bleached boots sticking out from beneath dark ponchos made slick by the fog. Cortell waited for them there. His head was bandaged. When he felt that all who were coming had gathered, he pulled out a small pocket Bible and read some verses aloud. Jackson was silently mouthing,
"Jank, why did you do it?"
Fracasso stood uneasily behind Cortell. At the Naval Academy, no one had ever talked about what to do afterward. Fracasso had asked Jackson to take over the squad. Jackson refused. Puzzled, Fracasso talked things over with Bass, who told him the probable cause. So Fracasso switched Jackson and Hamilton, giving Hamilton the squad. Jackson hoisted the heavy radio over his flak jacket. He'd made his deal. He'd stick with it. The day-long twilight faded. The medevac birds weren't coming. Kids who'd been drinking their water in anticipation of a resupply were sorry they hadn't been more sparing. Down in the bunker where they had pulled the serious cases, Scheller watched helplessly as the dwindling IV fluid drained into the wounded. When the other corpsman left the bunker to dig in for the night, he quietly slipped the IV tubes from 2 unconscious kids and poured the fluid into the bottles hanging above the others. Merritt, a rifleman from Goodwin's platoon, was watching him. He was one of the 3 wounded who were still conscious.
"What are you doing, Doc?"
he whispered. His torn clothes were plastered to his body by drying blood. Dirt was in everything, and there was no way to clean it out. The squids just poured antiseptic in with the dirt. A candle flickered, disturbed by the damp air as Scheller sat down.
"Just changing your oil and water," he said, smiling. "You took it from Meeker?"
Scheller nodded. Merritt stared up at the slightly rotting logs that formed the roof of the bunker just 4 feet above his head. He smelled blood and abandoned fermented fish sauce and rice.
"Is it wrong to want to go home so badly?"
he asked. Scheller, smiling gently, shook his head. Merritt took a labored breath. The pain in his intestines, where he'd been hit by 2 bullets, one shattering his pelvis, nearly drove him into blissful unconsciousness. But he fought off entering that dark realm, afraid he would never want to come back.
"Does it mean Meeker will die?"
Scheller looked over at the 2 kids he'd picked for death. He didn't want to answer Merritt's question. He wanted to lie, even to himself.
"I think you'll all make it," he said. "Don't fucking lie to me, Squid. I don't have time for it."
Again, Merritt took a quivering breath, biting back the scream that wanted to erupt whenever he filled his lungs.
"If I'm going to live because of Meeker, I want to know it. And I want to live."
Scheller put his hand on Merritt's uniform.
"The thing is, we might be wasting plasma on Meeker. He keeps bleeding inside, and I can't stop it. You're not bleeding as fast as he is."
Merritt looked at Scheller.
"I'll never forget it, Squid. I fucking promise."
Then he turned his head toward Meeker's unconscious body.
"Meager, you dumb son of a bitch," he whispered. "I ain't never gonna forget it."
Meager died 3 hours later. Scheller and Fredrickson dragged him out of the bunker and stacked him on the foggy landing zone with the rest of the bodies. In the Battalion Operations Center, Simpson and Blakely debated whether or not to press the attack against Matterhorn the next day. The kill ratio looked bad. 13 Marine KIA against only 10 confirmed NVA bodies. If they could continue the action, there was a chance that they could get the ratio up to something more reportable. But how many of the enemy were on Matterhorn? Was it a full force or just a rear guard? Or an advance guard? Fitch could report only that he saw movement in the bunkers, but there was no way of telling how many NVA were inside them. And now it was pitch black up there. At this moment, the NVA could be reinforcing or withdrawing. "There's only one way to find out," Simpson said grimly. "We've got to attack, at first light." Blakely knew Simpson was right. If the NVA reinforced during the night, an assault by Bravo Company would surely go badly. But those were the breaks. They were there to kill gooks. If they ran into a buzzsaw, Mulvaney would get the whole fucking regiment involved and finally kick some ass up there. If the gooks had taken off for the border and it was only a rear guard, then Bravo could handle it and Simpson would look foolish not to have pressed the attack, even if it was just to get more information. That was the right move. Now, one could second-guess them. If they kept Bravo sitting on the hill, that could be perceived up at division as a lack of initiative. There was the problem of artillery in those goddamn bunkers they'd left behind. The 105 batteries had all been pulled back to support the Comm-Low operation. The 8-inch howitzers on Sherpa had barely been able to reach the valley to the south of Matterhorn. Moreover, even if they could be moved closer, a direct hit from an 8-inch shell would probably not collapse one of those bunkers. Blakely had seen Bravo Company build them. Maybe it had been hasty to pull out of there so fast. Those were the breaks. In any case, it wouldn't look like an unsupported attack, especially since Bravo had been the one to fuck up the air support during the initial assault, and no one had lodged any complaints. And if Bainford could keep some fixed wing on station, and they did get a break in the clouds, they could lay in some snake and nape and watch those kill ratios climb. At 23:35, Fitch received the order to attack Matterhorn. The lieutenants stumbled and crawled to Fitch's bunker through the foggy blackness. Their faces appeared in the entry hole lit by Fitch's red lens flashlight. First Goodwin, haggard but still quipping, then Fracasso, shaken, wearing his partly shattered glasses. Finally Kendall, apprehensive, knowing it was his turn for the next dangerous task. Again they argued and struggled over how to take the hill. They interviewed all the kids who could remember anything about the details of the bunkers they'd built, the layout and hidden gates of the razor wire they'd put in place. Again, they were hampered by terrain and weather. But now they were also hampered by their own wounded and dead. "We can't take the wounded with us on the assault," Fitch said. "We've got to secure this hill." "And split our forces exactly like the fucking gooks did?" Mellis argued. "That's the only reason we were able to get up here in the first place. We've got to pack our wounded with us."
"Maybe we could leave a squad," Goodwin said.
"A squad can't cover this whole fucking hill," Fitch said. "Besides, if they got in trouble, we'd have to send back a platoon from Matterhorn to help them, if we had a platoon to send back. Then we'd be split in three, one on each hill and one on the saddle between them. All three would get the shit kicked out of them."
"There it is," Fracasso said, suddenly understanding the phrase. They finally agreed with Fitch. An entire platoon plus the command post group would stay with the wounded on Helicopter Hill. Two platoons would assault Matterhorn. If the two assaulting platoons got into trouble, Fitch could send two squads from the platoon guarding the wounded. This would leave just a single squad guarding the wounded. If both assaulting platoons were in trouble, however, that risk had to be taken.
"Why not just wait until we have enough horses for the job?" Mellis asked.
"The Six feels we'll lose the initiative."
"You mean he's afraid the gooks will DD and we'll be stuck with 13 dead and 40 wounded and only a worthless hill and 10 confirmed to show for it," Mellis said.
"There it is," Fitch said. They settled on a plan that would use the fog and their knowledge of the terrain to their advantage. Two platoons would work their way through the razor wire in the darkness and attack just before dawn. It was Kendall's turn for the hard stuff. Goodwin and Fracasso called Fitch's flip of the coin to see who would join Kendall. Fracasso lost.
"Who did you put in Jenks' place?" Mellis asked Fracasso.
"Hamilton. Jackson wouldn't take it, so I made him my radio man."
"They're both good men," Mellis said.
Everyone was silent, looking at the map in the circle of dim red light.
"Maybe all the gooks have DD'd across the border," Fitch said.
"Yeah,"
Kendall answered. Vancouver was the first to touch the wire. He gently pushed it upward, testing it, searching for the gate he knew was there. The wire resisted. He backed down. He crawled slightly to the left and tried again. Connolly, Jacobs, and Hamilton were doing the same thing. The rest of 1st Platoon waited, heads buried in the damp earth, almost afraid to breathe. Fracasso listened anxiously for a static burst, which would signal that Kendall and 3rd Platoon were through the wire and in position. Kendall had led his platoon quietly west through the jungle, aiming for the south side of Matterhorn. He stopped and looked at his compass. The luminescent needle swayed, then steadied. It always pointed north. Always. But what good did that do if he didn't know whether the hill was in front of him or to his right? He gulped and shoved the compass back into its pouch on his belt. Cold panic welled up in his stomach. If they were going south... No, they were going west toward Laos. But if the ridge ran south, it could be leading his platoon prematurely up the slope of Matterhorn before they could get into position on the south side. He tapped the shoulder of the kid ahead of him. "Bear a little to the left," he whispered. Kendall's platoon began heading away from Matterhorn. Hamilton suddenly felt the wire give easily. He felt further and located one of the stakes around which the wire was loosely secured. He crawled backward, leaving tiny scraps of a sea ration box as he went. The dull white of the cardboard could be seen up to a foot away. The word passed back to Fracasso. Then, as agreed, Connolly began to crawl through the gate, remembering each turn as he went, leaving a trail of cardboard. Vancouver followed, pushing his machine gun before him. His sword was tied firmly to his leg so it would make no noise. The rest followed, praying that the fog they'd cursed so many times in the past would now save them, praying against all odds that no one would be waiting for them beyond the wire, praying that the NVA had retreated in the night. Sams, at the rear of Kendall's column, figured out that Kendall was headed away from Matterhorn. Furious, he started keying the handset to get Kendall's attention. Fracasso mistook the keying of the handset to mean that Kendall was in place. He tapped the person in front of him. Three taps. Third herd's in place. The taps went up the line. Connolly emerged from the far end of the gate and began crawling to the right. The blackness, the crawling, the fear, none of it would ever end. At the same time, he didn't want it to end. What followed would be far worse. Kendall heard the handset keying furiously and knew that he'd been caught doing something terribly wrong. He immediately stopped. The word passed up in low whispers, "We're going the wrong fucking way." Kendall, crushed by a sense of failure, groped backward along the column. His radio operator followed. They met Sam's, and there was an intense flow of barely audible words. "What the fuck are you doing? I ought to shoot you right here. Now, goddammit, you are going to follow me until we reach the fucking wire, and if I hear so much as a fucking sound, you're going to get blown away." Kendall dropped back into the center of the platoon. Sams led the way, retracing their steps. Dawn would arrive in minutes. The Marines of 1st Platoon were lying in the mud, trapped between the wire and the enemy bunkers, waiting. Fracasso was frantic. Kendall was supposed to begin the attack. What the fuck was Kendall doing? He looked at his watch, holding it so close to his eyes that the dial was blurred. In a few minutes, the light would start coming. All along the line, there was anguished perplexity. What happened to 3rd Herd? Why were they waiting in this fucking death trap? Fracasso wanted to cry. He wanted to turn around and crawl back through the wire, but he knew that the platoon would never make it out before daylight. Halfway in, halfway out, he'd lose most of them. Then Fracasso noticed the faint white of the dial of his watch mingling with the glow of its phosphorescent hands. Daylight had not waited.
"Holy Mary, pray for us now,"
he whispered. "And at the hour of our death." He lurched to his feet and roared as he threw the grenade he had been holding in his right hand. All along the line, the platoon threw their grenades as hard as they could, aiming for their former bunkers. Explosions ripped across the hill, lighting fierce and frightened faces. Fracasso, firing his M16 on full automatic, ran screaming up the hill, covering the short distance between them and the bunkers in about 5 seconds.
"They're fucking empty!"
he shouted as he approached the first one.
"They're fucking empty!"
The entire platoon surged along beside him, and everyone felt a great weight lift from his back. Then, from the new holes just above the old bunkers where the NVA unit, reduced in size, had moved during the night, bright fire blazed out of the gloom. Fracasso, singled out by at least 5 riflemen as the leader, went down instantly. When the fire erupted from above the empty bunkers, everyone wanted to crawl underground. Several kids, in fact, went down on their knees. Had the others done the same, the attack would have stopped, and the outcome would have been a disaster. But the attack went on, not because of any conscious decision, but because of friendship. Jackson went running forward, more to see if Fracasso was alive than for tactical reasons. Vancouver saw Jackson heading for the lieutenant and decided that even if the platoon were in a hopeless shit sandwich, he'd be goddamned if he'd let Jackson run forward alone. So he kept going. Connolly, seeing Vancouver charging forward, did exactly the same, although his mind cried out to him to merge with the great welcoming earth beneath his feet. He wouldn't abandon a friend to go it alone. Neither would any of the others. Jackson, who'd been nicked on the arm by the concentration of fire on Fracasso, saw Vancouver surging ahead, shell casings flying from his machine gun. Jackson couldn't let him go alone, nor did he see any advantage in trying to crawl back through the wire. He kept running forward, though forgetting to fire his weapon. A man in good condition can run 100 meters in about 12 seconds. Uphill, with rifles and ammunition, a flak jacket, a helmet, water, grenades, heavy boots, and maybe a last can of pecan roll, the run takes a lot longer. There were approximately 25 meters between the old bunkers and the new fighting holes from which the NVA soldiers were firing. It took approximately 5 seconds to cross that deadly ground. In that time, 1/3 of the remaining 34 in the platoon went down. Then attackers and defenders joined together and bellowing, frightened, maddened kids, firing, clubbing, and kicking, tried to end the madness by means of more madness. Vancouver jumped into a hole with 2 small NVA soldiers, firing his machine gun right up against their chests, his muzzle blasts lighting the 3 of them as if by strobe lights. One of them, before he died, put a bullet through Vancouver's left arm, shattering the bone above the elbow. Vancouver clawed his way out of the hole, mad with pain but trying to reach the top of the hill. When he emerged from over the lip of the flattened top of Matterhorn, he saw the commander of the NVA unit shouting his men across the LZ to aid those defending the east approach. Vancouver saw the NVA officer look at him in surprise. Even in the pre-dawn gloom, Vancouver could see that the officer was no older than Mellis or Fracasso. The young man reached for his pistol, which was tied with a lanyard around his neck and rested in a shoulder holster. Several others, seeing the large Marine, his arm dripping blood, turned their AK-47s on him. Vancouver, unable to raise his machine gun barrel because of his crippled arm, went to ground beneath the lip of the LZ. He rolled to the left, freeing the ammunition belt to enter the gun's receiver. He rested the barrel of the gun on the lip of the LZ and pulled the trigger. The officer went down, wounded, and a knee of one of the soldiers firing at Vancouver was shattered. Vancouver began to pump short, steady bursts across the flat LZ, forcing the NVA reinforcements to work their way around the hill the long way. The NVA officer, shouting, crawled to reach a former artillery pit. Soon 2 soldiers carrying a drum canister machine gun joined him. the officer directed their fire against Vancouver. A burst of bullets tore the earth around Vancouver's eyes, forcing his head down as the bullets sucked across the flat table between them. As Vancouver's head went down, the officer shouted something, and a group of his men rushed across the LZ. Vancouver suddenly understood the game. As long as he could keep firing, the reinforcements were slowed, giving the platoon time to break through the line of holes. He looked behind him and saw Connolly running for a fighting hole with a grenade, and two other Marines on their knees firing at the hole to keep its occupants' heads down. A minute was all that was needed. The defenses would be pierced. If 3rd Platoon made it in time, they'd overrun the enemy lines. The 5 NVA soldiers were now halfway across the LZ. Vancouver poked his head above the rim of earth and emptied his belt at them. 2 went down wounded. 2 hit the earth voluntarily and crawled for another empty artillery pit. 1 turned back to join the officer and the machine gun crew, who continued firing at Vancouver. Vancouver's left shoulder was torn apart by one of the gun's bullets. His arm, already wounded, became a bloody, flopping, uncontrollable appendage. One-handed, he fumbled awkwardly to reload his machine gun. Large spots of gray-black obscured the feed tray and cover. He shook his head, trying to clear his vision. His single hand wouldn't work right. It felt clumsy and slow. He heard Bass screaming at him but couldn't understand the words. He heard Connolly's grenade go off and saw Connolly rise from next to the hole and fire a burst into it. Muzzle blasts winked in the gloom along the line of holes. The NVA officer shouted again. The 2 soldiers in the other gun pit rose once more to move toward Vancouver. Another group emerged from the same pit as the officer. Just a few seconds were all Bass and Connolly needed. Vancouver pulled his sword from his side. He had never really expected to use the damn thing. He'd had fun joking with the new boot lieutenant and Bass and the gunny about it. He slipped out of his gun harness and emerged over the lip of the flat ground of the LZ, snarling, his face black, his helmet fallen off, blonde hair matted with blood. His left arm hung helpless, but in his right hand he held the sword raised above his head. He would run and scream for 30 seconds, and then it would all be over one way or the other. The NVA soldiers at the machine gun couldn't turn it on Vancouver, because he was already between their 2 comrades who'd started running across the LZ toward him. Both of them were now going down under his hacking sword. A short, thickly built sergeant from the 2nd group of NVA soldiers ran straight for where Vancouver and the 2 others were fighting, and then stopped short. Vancouver finished the 2nd soldier off and turned to attack the sergeant. The sergeant pointed his rifle and fired 3 quick shots. 2 went into Vancouver's stomach. He sank to the ground. The sergeant fired again. Vancouver shuddered and crumpled over. The man waved his squad forward, running for the edge of the landing zone. One of the 2 NVA soldiers whom Vancouver had attacked cried weakly for help. Vancouver, his face in the mud, heard him and knew they would die together. That felt appropriate somehow. The small group of NVA reached the edge of the LZ just as Sams fought his way through the wire on the south slope. Wild with despair and shame at having left 1st Platoon to go it alone, he hurled himself against the wire, not bothering to find the gate. Bullets churned the dirt around him. The dim light was foiling the NVA's aim. Sams tore at stakes, pulled the wire up, and shouted to his men through the gloomy fog. Finally, he tore free. Bleeding from his arms and legs, he rushed past the empty bunkers, heading for the line of new holes above him. Miraculously, bullets slammed past him. Sams saw the NVA reinforcements silhouetted against the gray dawn light. Lunging to the earth, he fired 2 quick bursts, watching the flight of the tracers he had interspersed after every 5 bullets. He quickly adjusted his aim, sending the bullets into the small group of reinforcements. Luckily for Bravo Company, Sams thought, the NVA were 30 seconds too late. The rest of 3rd Platoon went swarming past him as he emptied his magazine. His radio man, also bleeding after being torn by the wire, flopped down beside him. Sams, heedless of the radio operator, ran forward, heading toward the fire coming from 1st Platoon. Some NVA soldiers were backing up the hill, firing as they went. Others stayed in their holes, fighting until the last. Sams scrambled over the top of a small acclivity on the side of the hill and came into full view of 1st Platoon. One of the new kids snapped his rifle around and fired a quick burst. Cortell jumped on the newbie, shouting, "Friendlies! Friendlies on the left!" Sams stared at the two of them. Two bullets were in his chest, one stopping his heart. "You dumb fucking nummy," he said calmly as sick blackness swirled into his brain and his hands and forearms started to buzz. He sank to his knees and curled over in a ball like a child going to sleep. The rest of Sams's platoon came storming around the shoulder of the hill. Some stopped when they saw him lying there. Bass shouted at them, pointing at the breach in the NVA lines with his short-timer's stick. The kids from 3rd Platoon, feeling disgraced at having let 1st Platoon down, charged through the gap, firing as they ran. They surged across the LZ, which was deserted now, and descended on NVA holes from above and behind. Whistles shrilled. Within seconds, the NVA were retreating in an orderly fashion down the west slope of Matterhorn toward Laos. Bass ran after 3rd Platoon, knowing he'd have to stop them from chasing the enemy all the way down the hill and exposing themselves to counterattack. Skosh, with a rib broken by a nearly spent bullet, struggled to follow Bass. Kendall, not knowing what to do, was following his platoon.
"Get them set up for a counterattack," Bass yelled at him.
Kendall nodded and started shouting at them to stop and set in. Bass ran back to 1st Platoon to try to set up a defense, directing people with his stick, waving it in the air, pointing with it to weak spots. He saw Vancouver's body and the bloody sword. He turned Vancouver over quickly, saw the familiar face of the dead, and ran on, calling to Hamilton and Connolly to link up with Kendall's platoon at both ends. Skosh, his chest still heaving, stopped to pull the sword from Vancouver's hand. Vancouver looked like a dog that had been run over.
"You big, dumb, gungy fucking Canadian," Skosh said. He keyed his handset.
"Bravo, this is Bravo 1 assist,"
Palak answered immediately.
"Go, 1 assist,"
Skosh keyed the handset.
"The big victor's dead, over."
He let up on the handset. Palak quietly repeated the message to Fitch and Mellis. It was as if the company's soul had been taken away. A minute later, they heard the ominous sound of distant mortar rounds firing out of tubes. Then the NVA mortar rounds came whistling down out of the luminous gray sky. The wounded lay exposed along the east side of Matterhorn. The mortar shells walked with fiery feet among them, occasionally stumbling on one, leaving a meat-red footprint. Some of the wounded tried to crawl for cover. Others, unable to move, watched the sky in numb terror or simply shut their eyes, praying for a friend to reach them and drag them to safety. Their friends came. With insufficient personnel to man the company's original perimeter, Bass moved everyone into the NVA's holes. There, the kids huddled against the earth and waited for the shelling to stop, and then, perhaps, for the counterattack to start. Bass had another concern beyond the counterattack and evacuating his wounded. If attacked, they would be firing on their own dead who lay on the slope of the hill. Even dead, they were still Marines. He remembered Jankiewicz giving his life to break the ring of interlocking fire that stopped the first assault on Helicopter Hill. He knew what Vancouver had done for them. The dead, for Bass, were not dead.
"Fuck it," he said to Skosh. "If they attack now, we'll fight 'em down there."
He rose from his hole just as three NVA shells erupted in a quick series. Shrapnel and dirt tore through the fog.
"Everyone up! Everyone up! We're not done yet! We got work to do! Marines, get up!"
Frightened kids peered at him from their holes. He was waving his short-timer stick.
"Get up! We're going to get the bodies! Get up!"
He ran down the slope. They all rose from their holes, even Skosh with his broken rib. It looked like an assault in reverse. Through the exploding shells, they called to each other, some with rebel yells, some shouting,
"Fuck it! Fuck it all!"
They ran for their dead. Some fell to the flying shrapnel. They were picked up, having barely touched the earth, and dragged back up the hill with the dead bodies. In 1 minute, the slopes were cleared. Then, As if God had pulled a curtain, the fog lifted completely. The Marines on Helicopter Hill saw Matterhorn standing naked before them. Little figures in camouflage green scurried here and there, dragging other little figures in camouflage green behind them or walking with others hanging onto their shoulders.
"Get those fucking birds, Snick!" Fitch shouted gleefully.
Malice could see Bass clearly on the top of Matterhorn, pointing his short-timer stick at something, shouting at someone. With the fog gone, however, NVA on the ridge north of Matterhorn began laying automatic weapons fire, in with the mortar explosions. All movement on the LZ was stopped. Fitch and Malice looked at each other hopelessly. The birds couldn't come in unless the weather was clear. But if it was clear, the NVA had the Marines pinned down with automatic weapons. Then a cry went up from those on Helicopter Hill.
"Tubing! Tubing!"
The Marines had been digging a second perimeter inside the first. They no longer had enough men to defend the outer one, but they stopped and began burying themselves in the dirt. They waited for the time it took between the sounds of the tubing, which went in a direct line to their ears, and the time it took the rounds to complete their high arcs. The mortar rounds crashed harmlessly far down the hillside. Then the Marines were up again, digging furiously to complete the new perimeter. Mellis felt a sickening dismay. The sounds of the tube pops had come from a different direction from the first ones. Mellis ran down to the lines, diving into Goodwin's hole, from which he hoped to hear the second set of tubings and help Daniels with a cross-bearing.
"You gotta hand it to them little fuckers,"
Goodwin said to Mellis, waiting for the next volley of mortars.
"They're fucking pros. Too bad they ain't on our side."
"Just wait a while," Mellis said. "They were on our side 25 years ago."
"No shit. Who switched sides, us or them?"
"I think it was us. We used to be against colonialism. Now we're against communism."
"I'll be goddamned," Goodwin said matter-of-factly.
"Whatever we're against, Jack, they're fucking pros."
Mellis held up his hand, listening intently for the next sounds of tubing. As soon as they came, he took a bearing and radioed it back to Daniels on Goodwin's radio. Then he waited for the mortar shells to complete their slow, high trajectory. He watched the top of the cloud bank that swirled beneath the two hilltops and obscured the valleys below them. Matterhorn seemed unattached to the earth, an ugly bulb rising out of silvery gray. Then the shells hit, all over and inside the perimeter. The Marines curled down, hands over their ears, and tried to squeeze inside their helmets. The shelling continued for 15 minutes. Just 15 minutes. Then it stopped. Mellis waited 2 minutes. He peered over the edge of the crater and then got up to check the damage. He found the senior squid already out, patching someone up. Goodwin reported 2 more killed. They'd both been in the same hole. Otherwise, they were only minor shrapnel wounds. Mellis walked back to Fitch's hole. Relznick looked up, his face working. Palak was looking away.
"What is it?"
Fitch broke the silence.
"Bass is dead," he said quickly. As if he were trying to atone for this terse announcement, he added, "We don't have enough effectives to cover both hills. As soon as we get the wounded off of Matterhorn, I'm pulling 1 and 3 back here."
It took Mellis a moment to register both pieces of information. Even then, his next question was automatic. It was all he could say to fill the emptiness.
"How?"
he asked numbly.
"Shrapnel. He bled to death."
Mellis turned around and walked back to the edge of the lines facing Matterhorn. It was quiet. Matterhorn floated serenely above the fog. He saw Bass on Matterhorn just weeks earlier, teaching him, joking with him, bitching to him. Bass wrapping him in a blanket one day after a patrol when he was so cold he couldn't stop shivering. Fixing a cup of coffee. Talking about home. The Corps. Bass. Dead. On this fucking wasted piece of earth. Goodwin came up behind Mellis and put a hand on his helmet and rocked it back and forth. He didn't say anything.
"Thanks, Scar," Mellis finally said.
Mellis's throat ached. Tears crowded close behind his eyelids. But the ache was never released, and the tears never broke through. Emptiness filled his soul.
"Hey!"
someone shouted on the south side of the perimeter.
Here come the birds!
Out of the fog to the south, a single CH-4